Many of these beliefs and underworld societies had strong occult connections. They were not so much against the then predominant Christian religions as coming from a completely different and much older tradition. In this sense, they tied in with the paganism that characterized the old Greek religions and the many ideas of magic, that is to say, breaking the laws of science and bending the world as we know it to the will of the few. In my day, these views were gaining strength. From what I know of the days before Skydark, they were still growing in strength. The idea of witchcraft, powers greater than those known by humans, are they so different from the idea that there are those on the outside of the earth with a greater power? Is not the idea of a superior alien race nothing more than an old pagan god explained by increased technology? Ideas of an advanced society living on a surviving Atlantis deep in the earth crossed over with ideas that these were in fact super beings from another world who became stranded here or who had the power to go beyond our world. Of course, you may ask why they stayed in the center of the earth or allowed themselves to sink in the first place if they had such powers, but belief systems rarely cover all the angles. The traditional colors of magic, the occult hues that carry power, have always been red, white, and black. The lack of black here is a little perplexing in light of this, but I suspect that either something has been a little lost in the passing down of the traditions post-nuke cost, or else there is black in Atlantis, if not here.
He paused, waiting to see if his words had made any kind of sense, or had been little more than gibberish to their ears. From their expressions, he realized they had given them a lot to digest. Time to wrap it up and see what they had to say.
The only thing left, I think, is how the idea of Greece, Atlantis, and the UFOs tie together. In a sense, I have already answered this in outlining the significance of color. I believe that the ideas concerning superior races, the occult, and some kind of supermen from outer space have somehow become mixed.
That's it! I knew it made some kind of sense somewhere, right at the back of my mind, buried. I remember when I was ill, just before the shit hit the fan and I hit the freezer. When I was a kid, we used to have my cousin Martin stay with us, and we used to sneak in late at night and watch TV. So many bad sci-fi and horror movies. Anyway, when I was ill, Martin gave me this book for when I was in the hospital. I guess he just picked it up and thought it was about old movies. It was, in a way, but it was some kind of crank book about how the government was feeding us information about UFOs through bad movies to get us ready for when it was revealed the little green men were real. It was a crock of shit book that contradicted itself all over the place, but there was one bit that really caught my eye. The writer kept referring to how much red, black, and white was used in color sci-fi movies and explained the occult history of the colors. God! You don't think the first Atlanteans based their society on some crank book? Come on, that's just too... Star Trek.
I don't know. I'm not sure if I've even followed half of what the hell you two have been talking about. But I do know one thing. We've seen Vels base their way of life on screwier things than this. And it doesn't matter. Now that we know, maybe we can understand why they think and act like they do. Maybe you can give us some kind of insight into how we can help them bring down Odyssey.
I agree with you. The veracity of the source is unimportant. What it may highlight is that if Odyssey and his predecessors have been serious about reaching other planets, particularly those who founded the Vill, then we may be up against some extremely hazardous old tech, and we need to tread carefully.
Doc's right. If they've got old shit we haven't seen before, there's no knowing what it could do to us.
Triple red, then. Until we know exactly what we're up against, we don't make any rash moves.
From the outside, no sound could penetrate the inches-thick layers of brick and stone that constituted his inner sanctum. It had been one of the first edifices constructed after the nuclear winter of Skydark, and had stayed erect and proud as a monument to the power of the dynasty of Odyssey. Seven men of that name had lived within its walls, each preparing for the day when they would be saved. This Odyssey sat brooding over the reports. The people of Memphis, particularly those fools Cyan and Mark, thought they had achieved autonomy and escaped from the Father Empire. How wrong they were. There would always be dissidents, and they would always seek to escape. The secret of leadership wasn't in forcing them to stay, perhaps spreading unrest within, but in letting them out on a leash, like an overexcited dog, so that they thought they had freedom that could be jerked back when they stretched too far. It suited Odyssey to let these dissidents set themselves up as another vill. But he would send sect parties out to catch some, bring them back for ritual slaughter, a culling of the dissenters, and a lesson to those who stayed and worked. Ultimately, however, he had them exactly where he wanted them. On the outside, they could pretend they were free without disturbing the running of Atlantis. Yet they were still under close observation and monitoring, so that any root sign of a problem could be crushed underfoot before it had a chance to grow and become a choking weed, a thorn in his side. Odyssey looked at the stunted tree in an earthenware pot that stood in a corner of the room. It disgusted him, a symbol in its weakness of what this world had become. Perhaps that was why he thought of Memphis. They too were weak, stunted, and disgusted him. A sense that grew stronger as he considered the reports. Easy as it would be in real terms to crush Memphis, the fact that there was an outside colony acted as a device to siphon off the small but continuous stream of dissenters within Atlantis. Take this away, and disorder could fester within the vill. So, as much as he would like to detail teams of nightcrawlers to simply take out the problem at its source, he had to play a waiting game. And there was nothing more frustrating than that when you were a man accustomed to flexing your fist and obtaining immediate results. There was little doubt in his mind that the current report spelled danger, a danger that could grow if not checked. The problem was how he did this without upsetting the delicate balance he'd established between his domain and the satellite of Memphis. He felt the need to speak of this, yet to whom? The name and rank of Odyssey, all that it entailed, was handed down, and with it came an absolute power that meant absolute isolation. To discuss a course of action was to show weakness, and that could never be done. The reports were written in black ink on a red woven paper edged in white. They were prepared by the agents he had placed within the Vill of Memphis, who posed as dissidents, but used their position to monitor events within the Vill and report back via rendezvous with nightcrawlers. It was a simple system, aided by the incompetence of the Memphis sec. Should they gain a degree of skill in their task, then he would be forced to consider another course of action. That, however, had looked far from likely. Until now. He glanced at the hieroglyphs that covered the red surface. They made him ill at ease. Strangers rarely made it this far past the desolation that curbed their territory. Strangers who wished to stay for a while were rarer still. Rarest of all were those who appeared to have knowledge and combat skill. Up until now, he had remained calm. Now the cold fury that had been building within him erupted into a white heat of passion. Snarling, he took the reports and ripped them up, throwing the pieces to the far corners of the room. Breathing heavily, he forced himself to calm down. He couldn't be seen to exude any kind of emotion other than a serene reassurance that all was going to plan. That, too, was part of his training. Except that things weren't. The new vessel for the journey was behind schedule. The phases of the moon and stars would soon come into alignment once more, and if this time the travelers didn't return to retrieve those left behind, then it would not happen in Odyssey's lifetime. The next alignment was many seasons away. From history, from his own childhood, the last time there had been an alignment and the travelers hadn't come, he knew that for a phase to pass with no action resulted in unrest and a testing time for the incumbent Odyssey. The problem with the prophecy, the thing that the people didn't understand, was that the travelers hadn't specified a date for their return, only an alignment that would be in the night skies. This wasn't the fault of the leader. All any man with the name Odyssey could do was prepare a vessel for transport and hope that now was the time. But the disappointment and frustration of the people was vented on the leader. It was inevitable. But didn't they realize that the leader felt that frustration too? And now there was this obscure threat, coming at a time when he should be preparing for the final push toward the time of alignment. Odyssey looked around him, at the walls of his inner sanctum. The only light was cast by flickering lamps and torches mounted on the stone walls, as he was in the center of the building with no windows and corridors and anterooms surrounding him on all four sides. Each room, each corridor, sealed by a lock that could only be opened by those who knew the combination. Part of him wondered if this was to keep the people out or to keep him caged in. No matter. The walls were hung with red, black, and white tapestries. In pictographs, they depicted the history of Atlantis, from the earliest days when the island continent had flourished, through the sinking of the original lands and its rebirth in this location. Hardwood chairs, a simple table covered in papers and the remnants of a meal, and a long chaise covered in white cushions were the only furniture, with additional decoration supplied only by the stunted tree and a few weak plants in smaller pots. Sculptures of old Greek gods filled one corner, but they weren't decoration, a shrine to those who had come before the revelation from space, who were no longer godheads, but were still revered as prophets. The room was 20 feet high, 40 wide, yet it seemed like a casket, burying him within it at this moment. The cool air that circulated from ducts built into the structure of the temple now seemed dank and rancid, as though he were breathing in his own despair. Enough of these thoughts rattled around in his head without reaching any kind of resolution. To think only made them louder, resounding in his skull until they blotted out the capacity to think. He had to voice them. Leaving the fragments scattered across the floor, he strode to the doorway and twisted the red, white, and black combination lock until it released the door. As he left, the guard stationed outside snapped to attention.
Where is Xerxes?
He will be at the vessel site, Master. It is inspection time.
He'd better be.
Odyssey walked away, leaving the guard relieved that he hadn't been arbitrarily punished. It wasn't beyond the realm of possibility that Odyssey would have had him killed merely because he was in a bad mood. Hitting the combinations and scowling at guards as he passed, Odyssey exited the building and came out onto the streets of Atlantis. To his rear, a flank of guards fell silently and unobtrusively into place. Once beyond the thick stone walls, Atlantis was bustling with activity. It was a carefully ordered society, with the rule of law imposed by crawlers who trained as set guards from birth. Everyone was selected for their tasks from birth, decided for them by heredity. Most followed in the footsteps of their parents, while some were specially selected from outstanding parents to progress to the next social level. The decision was always made by the leader, and for successive generations he had to keep a close watch on the development of his people. Guards begat guards, masons begat masons, bakers begat bakers. It was a rigidly maintained social order, and for the most part the people were happy with it. This was, of course, because they knew nothing different, and very few had ever questioned this. Most accepted that to be ready for the day when they or their descendants would finally take the journey to a better place, they had to fulfill their allotted tasks. People went about their everyday responsibilities with a renewed vigor as the days of alignment approached. There was work to be done, and they were happy to do it in the build-up to the joyous time. The streets of Atlantis were clean, the buildings painted white, red, and black. Most had been erected just before the new cost, and any damage that had been incurred during the time of Skydark had long since been repaired, in a manner to make it seem as though it had never occurred. The designs were classical in structure, with fluted columns supporting porticos over paved walkways. Square and rectangular buildings of clean line and little outward decoration lined the streets, which were themselves precisely divided into blocks of rectangular or square design. The streets were populated by men and women in robes, all of whom seemed happy enough, but none of whom stayed still long enough to stop and talk beyond a few brief greetings or matters of business. There was always too much work to be done, and not enough time. Furthermore, as the darkly brooding presence of Odyssey passed, those citizens nearest to him swiftly parted to cleave a clear path for him. His destination was obvious. There was only one site within the city that was under construction. As the population rose with each generation, so a larger vessel, taller and wider, was needed for the journey. The original temple, built at the same time as the rest of the city, had long since been made obsolete, torn down and rebuilt larger with succeeding generations. It was a constant battle against time, from generation to succeeding generation, to prepare the new vessel in time for the time of alignment. Odyssey found Xerxes, his sect chief, and the only man he could talk to, at the temple construction site. They had an unspoken understanding. and although it went against all the conventions of Atlantis, Odyssey had an implicit trust in his sec chief and in his ability to know his job better than anyone.